Well, hi everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
Hi, I'm Tom Schatz. I'm a recently retired professor and now an emeritus professor at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm kind of an old-fashioned film guy. Actually, I do quite a bit with conglomerate media, and I'm enjoying my retirement, but mainly keeping busy with writing. I've got a couple of book projects in the works, editing a few books for the University of Texas Press. And I'm living in Austin, Texas, and looking forward to getting out of here for the summer. And I have a nice lake house up north, away from the ungodly heat in Austin, which is just getting worse all the time. The new normal. So anyway, that's who I am.
And you mentioned the new normal, and I guess places like Texas, Arizona, California are experiencing, even by their standards, unheralded drought and heat conditions, right?
Correct. With California, obviously, it's been a combination of drought conditions and flooding.
And
So
flooding. Oh, yeah,
it's
right.
been we're yeah. The new normal is anything but normal. And it's anything but consistent. That's what's we're these severe weather events. This is actually we just got through a very mild winter in Austin, but two of the last 3 winters we've had very severe winter storms that the state of this part of Texas particularly not ready for. And so we you know it's Austin was we were without power for extended periods of time 2 out of the last 3 winters, and it's with the city being very ill-equipped to deal with a lot of ice and snow and that kind of thing. So
Yeah, these cities often have budgets that are predicated on an understanding of climate that is rapidly proving to be rather flawed. So, Prof. Tom, you just mentioned a number of projects you're working on. Perhaps we could start with learning a bit about those and then consider some of your classic books.
Okay, I just finished a big book on the rise of conglomerate Hollywood that looks basically at the movie industry from 1989 to 2004. 1989 was the year of the Time Warner and Sony Columbia mergers. And it was also the year of the Tim Burton Batman and Sex, Lies, and Videotape and Do the Right Thing and Michael Moore's first film, Roger and Me, which really started the so-called indie movement, which was quickly annexed by the studios as they launched their indie divisions. Or bought, Disney bought Miramax and Sony launched Sony Classics and so on and so forth. So I'm really looking at the kind of concurrent development of conglomerate control. By 2004, I end there because that's the year that GE bought NBC or created NBC Universal after buying Universal. And at that point, six companies owned everything. They owned all the studios. They owned all the major American TV networks, most of the cable networks, and controlling publishing, music, et cetera, theme parks. So I'm looking at that transition, and I'm particularly interested in this period because on the one hand, the blockbuster franchise mentality overwhelms mainstream Hollywood, but you've got this pretty robust independent movement going on at the same time, and this winds up being a pretty dynamic period in the in industry history. So I've just finished that book, doing revisions and actually shopping it around. I had thought about doing that as a trade book, but for various reasons, that's not going to happen, it looks like. And so that'll probably wind up being a university press book. I'm shopping it around literally right now. And I'm in the midst of a history of Universal Pictures. Routledge is doing something they're calling the Hollywood Centenary Series, which is a 7-volume series with one book devoted to each of the surviving major studios. And I've been invited to do the book on Universal. So I've done a lot of work on Universal in the past, and I'm doing a I'm doing yeah, I've got a lot of additional research I've been able to do. So I'm right in the middle of that book, which I'm enjoying. Unlike this Conglomerate Hollywood book, which took forever, the Universal book is I'm cranking it out and enjoying the writing, and it's an enjoyable exercise. Meanwhile, I'm editing several books. I've got a guy named Colin Tate is doing a book on De Niro, early De Niro, and really the basically the De Niro Scorsese relationship dominates this book, and quite a strong piece of work on De Niro's authorial responsibility for the Scorsese films and others, but mainly the Scorsese films. And I'm also doing a book by Emily Carmen on the Misfits, and a book and a couple of others. And those are that's an enjoyable sidelight. Takes up more of my time than I'd like sometimes, but it's a one way to keep an oar in the water in terms of the field, along with my own work.
And Tom, going back to the first of those that you mentioned, the book you're shopping around, Conglomerates and So-Called Independents, that makes me think back 55 years to the point where extraction and manufacturing companies were getting interested in Hollywood, but it was also the era of New Hollywood. It was the film school brats. Are there
Right.
corollaries you can see between, say, 1970 and 1990?
That's a great question. And the short answer is yes. So the last time that there was a, this is an interesting parallel. The last time there you saw kind of an onslaught of conglomerates was during the mid to late 60s, meaning the late 1960s, when Transamerica bought Kerkorian bought MGM, Transamerica bought UA. That would eventually go south with a vengeance. But you also had Kinney buying Warner, which would become Warner Communications, and you had Gulf and Western buying Paramount. So those deals all happened in the late 1960s. And the reason they happened is that the movie business was crashing and burning. There was a very severe recession in the movie industry in the late 60s, early 70s, and those acquisitions all came on the cheap, as they say. And if you think about it, all the companies I just mentioned, Gulf and Western, Kinney Services, et cetera, these are not media companies by any means.
No.
They're big conglomerates doing other stuff. And they basically had no idea what to do with the movie industry, meanwhile, you've got Easy Rider, MASH, you've got The Graduate, McCabe and Mrs. Miller. You've got all these great movies being made, primarily for the so-called youth market, which back then was college kids and young adults, and that was the most reliable market. In the late 60s and early 70s, Bonnie and Clyde. I mean, there were so many of these movies that really enabled a new generation of filmmakers to basically, I don't want to say take over the industry, but to be given kind of carte blanche to Robert Altman, or young Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, et cetera, who were just given carte blanche because they were able to make films that appeal to the youth market. And this was also at the in the midst of the French New Wave, the German New Cinema, et cetera. There was you had these international auteurs that were doing Bergman, et cetera, doing fabulous work, later Antonioni. And so this was another period where there was the so-called Hollywood Renaissance, and it wasn't independent though. It was unlike this more recent one. And don't let me get down into the weeds, which I'm liable to do if we're not careful. But there was clearly a stretch there from the late 60s to the mid 70s, And where the lunatics took over the asylum, as the saying goes, and you had a it was a pretty robust. And this was when you probably, as long as well as myself, became interested in American film in a way that was that was quite different from what came as we continued our studies. The mid 70s, of course, things take a pretty significant turn with. With Jaws in 75, Rocky 76, Star Wars 77, Superman 78. I mean, and this new generation of blockbuster films, which really anticipated what happens a couple of decades later, in a much more concerted and successful way. So that was kind of rehearsal for the new Hollywood. What and then of course that so-called Renaissance, kind of runs out of gas in the late 70s as commercial interests take charge. And then you had, famously, you had, films like Heaven's Gate and, Scorsese's, very, kind of unfortunate last couple of movies in the early 80s. King of Comedy was the one that really took him down, but Coppola, Cotton Club. I mean, there were a number of films that signaled the end of that Renaissance, and there was quite a few years where the whole independent scene went off Hollywood, as they say, and where the studios resumed control. And this was also when the cable market took off, home video took off, and the economics of the industry changed as Hollywood learned to make these bigger blockbusters that by the 90s came to rule the industry.
Excuse my coughing away, Tom.
Yeah.
I'm battling flu. At the beginning of the period of your book, 89 to 2004, we have the end of Columbia Pictures and the high point of Japanese involvement in Hollywood. And
Correct. Sony buys Columbia in 89 and in a copycat merger, Matsushita, which would later be known by its international name Panasonic, just months later Matsushita buys Universal. So you've got Sony and Matsushita, Panasonic both swooping into Hollywood in 89, 90,
And
which was
there was
a pretty significant transition.
a moral panic at the time. Pardon me, about U.S. culture being taken over by Japan. The one of the baseball franchises was bought with Japanese money, as I recall. And there was a great deal of anxiety about selling off the family jewels and heritage. And the theory was that actually against that, they would be reined in and controlled by the deep forces, the deep structures of Hollywood. So, what's your take on that issue?
Well, a couple of things happen. One, as you well know, the Japanese economy crashes in the early 90s, 92, 93, and that really significant. And that basically, Panasonic, the Matsushita Panasonic forces, never adapted to the business, and they wind up selling out in the mid 90s. Sony, on the other hand, hunkers down and really does learn to manage the its Hollywood holdings. And Sony was also Columbia Records preceded the Columbia studio by, and Sony was extremely successful in a move into music, as well as movies, and but I do think that Sony played it pretty smart in terms of letting American executives run the music and movie operations in the U.S. But what's kind of ironic about the Japanese economy crashing is that this is the same time that that East Asia, Chinese is the Chinese economy is opening up on a global scale. You've got in 89, 90, you've got the fall of the Iron Curtain on the Soviet Union. So you've got the international marketplace, exploding, during this period. So, Japan looked like it was going to be an early power and all of that, but it turns out not to be as big a power as expected.
Indeed. And tell us about why you closed down the book in 2004. What happens then?
Okay, again, don't get me started. So I've got a big ambitious epilogue in this book that talks about post 2004. So 2004, as I mentioned, is the year that GE, after buying Universal, launch and already owns NBC, launches NBC Universal. And after that the buyout of Universal, the merger and acquisitions waves that have roiled away from 89 to 2004, they basically stopped. They stopped for more than a decade. After lots and lots of big crazy, I mean, in 2000, 2001, that's when you've got Time Warner being swallowed up by by AOL, American Online, right? And shortly thereafter, a big French company, Vivendi, which is moving into telecom and digital, buys Universal, and those are the two at the time that AOL technically bought Time Warner for $165 billion in one of the craziest deals of all time, and those both crashed with the bubble burst in 2000, 2001, 2002, and those both go south. But anyway, you had this enormous amount of merger and acquisition activity for 15 straight years, and it basically stops after 2004. A couple of other things happened as well. The global marketplace, the international marketplace, goes batshit in post 2004. So from the foreign markets for the studios gradually recover post 89 with fall of the Soviet Union, Chinese opening up to Far East Asia, et cetera. And by the turn of the century, you've got foreign revenues basically on a par with domestic revenues for the studios. So through the early 2000s, from 2000 to 2004, they stay on basically even keel. In 2004, the foreign markets surged 50% ahead of domestic. By 2010, they'd be twice domestic. By 2019, by the time the pandemic hits, three times domestic. So you've got, the foreign marketplace taking off. Not only that, but foreign overseas audiences love blockbuster franchise movies, and they are increasingly driving everything. So you've also got a new generation of top executives at the studios, Bob Iger, et cetera, Bukas, guys who came up through television, and basically siphon off their independent divisions. And basically, and Bukas is particularly is very out front about saying, why should we produce risky movies when these franchise films are doing such great business? And this is, Harry Potter, et cetera, et cetera. And you've got a steady diminishing of these conglomerate-owned indie divisions, the so-called IndieWood. And meanwhile, with them out of the picture, the independent market just steadily implodes. And you've got an industry that is increasingly internationalized and focused on these big blockbuster films. And by the time we get to the teens, it's another issue altogether with the rise of streaming, which we may or may not want to talk about. But it's not until 2018 would the next big mergers be finalized, and that was when AT&T takes over Time Warner. And Bukas really arranges that sale. He shops for a buyer, which turns out to be AT&T, and that doesn't go well, which we may or may not want to talk about. But a much bigger deal involved Disney buying Fox's media assets. So, and in the anticipation of launching Disney Plus in 2019. So you've got a so the M&A action, the merger and acquisitions action, stops after 2004 until the late teens, and it returns basically because of the threat posed by Netflix and Amazon.
And now Netflix is actually a member of the Motion Picture Association.
Is correct. In early 2019, on the same day in February 2019, the Oscar nominations are announced, with 10 Oscars going to Ro nominations going to Roma, including Best Picture. And on that very day, later that day, the MPAA announces that Netflix is the newest member. And are basically, so the Big Six remains the Big Six, with Fox departing, having been bought by Disney. So that's a pretty big deal. Roma's a big deal as well, because it's one of the first films that Netflix releases theatrically to qualify for the Oscars. So Netflix was then and still is trying to figure out what the hell to do with the theatrical market, which is a really interesting issue in terms of the transformation of the movie business over the last decade or so.
And Apple too, right? Wanting
Well,
to.
Apple and Amazon, yes, they're all trying to figure it out. And meanwhile, you've got some other big guys hovering, trying to decide whether to get involved in the media business at all. And this is, the fact is that Netflix, Amazon, and Apple, all of which are very actively producing feature films, don't need the U.S. theatrical market. I mean, it's a risk they have to decide whether they want to take, and they don't need it. I mean, they could buy and sell any one of those companies. These are trillion-dollar companies. Well, Apple and Amazon are trillion-dollar companies that could buy and sell the entire U.S. media industry if they wanted to. What's interesting about Netflix is it's the only company out of all the guys we're talking about that is not a conglomerate. That is basically a pure play media company. It's edging into gaming. It's edging into advertising supported video on demand, which is important because it's partnering with Comcast on, or it's who is it partnering with? Anyway, it'll come to me. But anyway, it's easing into a bigger media scenario. But for the time being, at least, Netflix is remaining, basically a media company.
And Tom, if we could go back, as they say in baseball commentary, to your book, The Genius of the System, borrowing from Bazar's statement, I guess, right?
Yes.
Is there still a genius in the system?
Well, the Andre Bazin quote, and which is pretty well stuck in my mind. But if Hollywood is a classical art, then why not admire in it what is most classical, which is not the genius of this or that filmmaker, but the genius of the system. And by this or that filmmaker, he was primarily talking about directors. This was an essay on the Politique des Auteurs, where he was warning his young charges at Cahiers du Cinéma, Truffaut, Godard, Romer, etc., that they were overplaying this auteur hand, and that they needed to recognize the genius of the system. So, that was the thrust of that book, and I stand by that argument, lo these many years later. And it was a different. The system was quite a bit different back then, and this Universal book has been an interesting exercise, because I'm back, writing about, I'm just finishing up the chapter on the 1930s and getting into the 1940s, and that really was when the studios were running the show, and when the system was not only more stable, but one might argue was, I mean, this is the so-called golden age of Hollywood, and referred to as a golden age, I think, for pretty good reason, late 30s into the 1940s.
And so, of course, one of the things that ends this is the Paramount Decree, supposedly, anyway, and the trust-busting desires of the Justice Department under Roosevelt that were put on hold at some level by the war. But what's interesting is that with the degutting of antitrust in the United States under Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, George W. Bush, everybody, we have seen a return to a kind of integration of production,
That's
distribution,
exactly
exhibition in
right.
some
Yeah,
cases.
this conglomerate era that I write about in this last book is very much the result of deregulation, and so you've got a situation where post-World War II, Paramount steps in just as television's taking off, and basically the Justice Department and the FCC basically forbid the movie studios from they wanted to launch their own TV stations. They wanted to take over the TV industry, and which they desperately needed to do because the post-war economic conditions were really doing in the traditional movie business. But you've got a period for decades, a couple of decades, through the 70s into the 80s, where the FCC and the Justice Department are basically keeping the media industry separate, media industry separate, and they're in their own silos. And not only that, but even within media industries, you've got a situation where the Justice Department and the FCC are keeping segments of industries apart. For example, the best example is that the TV networks became so powerful in the 60s that by 1970, you've got a whole new system of regulations that prevent the networks from owning from financing and distributing their own primetime programming. So anyway, you've got a fragmented, in a one might say a pretty healthy way, a fragmented media system in the but going into the 1980s. And here comes Ronald Reagan and liberal economics and a free market economy mentality. He installs basically a new FCC, a new FCC chair who shakes up the FCC, and with the instructions of deregulating. And you've got, here comes cable, as I mentioned before, et cetera. So you've got a rationale for opening up, deregulating, the industry. And that leads directly to Warner buying, Time Warner merging, and that was very much a deal that was controlled by a guy named Ross at Time Warner, who wanted HBO as much as the Time publishing holdings, and et cetera, et cetera. So you and you know the by the time we get to the Clinton signing that Communications Act, that's in 96, right after a period couple of, the period right before that is finalizes deregulation. I mean, that take all the gloves are off by then with the signing of that by Clinton in 96 and January 96. At that point, you in the previous 2 years, five of the integrated major studios changed hands or radically expanded by acquisition, Disney buying ABC, for example. So you've got this massive shakeup of the media industries and consolidation of the media industries. And it was, there never been anything like it. Even with the birth of Hollywood, back in the teens and early 20s, and that was very much a merger and acquisition situation. But the scale here was phenomenal by the time we get to the 90, 80s and 90s to the 90s, because it involved the film industry, the TV industry, the music industry, the publishing industry. I mean, it really did see consolidation on a scale that no one could have imagined before Reagan.
And of course, this is also the beginning of the period when, if you look at the best capitalized, most profitable sectors in the world economy, they move from being corporations involved in extraction and manufacturing to being corporations involved in culture, software, media content, and so on. Vastly outrun things like Total or Ford. and the names of the wealthiest people in the world suddenly shift from being many Japanese names to lots and lots of US names, and frequently from these media domains. So their centrality to the US and the world economy really explodes. But again, if we could go back for a moment to that wonderful book that had a huge influence on me, and I'm sure on many readers, The Genius of the System, could you explain a little bit more about why classical Hollywood really was so good, so appealing to so many of us?
Well, you had a system whereby you had eight companies dominated the industry, and five in particular. And these were the companies: Warner Brothers, Paramount, MGM, RKO, and Fox, that owned their own theater chains. Those theater chains basically generated, cash flow that enabled them to maintain their production factory. So the home office on the East Coast ran the theater chains, real estate, lots of income, et cetera, and the companies on the factories that they like to call studios on the West Coast generated content, generated movies. And you had a situation where you had a the home office and the factory was a, they were a continent apart. This is before anyway, we could talk about communication, transportation, et cetera, and just how far LA and New York were apart back then. But the distance proved to be healthy, I think, in a lot of ways, and that you really had executives running the studios. From Daryl Zanuck at Warner Brothers to Irving Thalberg at MGM, et cetera, that understood movies, and that cultivated talent in a way that was pretty peculiar to that era. So you had a and you had and this gets complicated, but you had contract systems. You had directors under contract to studios. You had stars under contract to studios. You had talent. You had thousands of people working at these studios, and with top talent under long-term contract, and you had a very systematic way of developing films, product that was geared to audience demand, and you had a dynamic relationship between the studios and the audience, particularly with this more or less direct feedback they're getting from their first run theaters that these top studios own. And what you see is, and when a lot of what I talk about in that book, Genius of the System, is about how Warner Brothers and MGM and Universal develop a house style. And that house style is geared toward star genre formulas. So Warner Brothers, in the course of the 1930s, develops these Bette Davis melodramas, urban crime films, so-called gangster films with Jimmy Cagney and Edward G. Robinson, swashbucklers with you've got Errol Flynn and Olivia de Havilland, and so on and so forth. So, and every studio is doing this to one degree or another, and in the process, top directors are, gaining more and more authority over their piece of that action. What also begins to happen by the late 30s and early 40s, because of changes in the tax codes and this and that, you've got top talent resisting the long-term contract system, and you've got more and more independent. You've got more and more filmmakers and top stars going independent. You've also got a number of top producers. Best example is David Selznick, who I write about a lot in that book, who, after being a production executive at Paramount and then RKO and then MGM, leaves MGM in 36 to start his own company, Selznick International. And he learns to operate within that system. But as a major independent producer, you've got Sam Goldwyn, major independent producer, early Disney, and at the same time, You've got well, you got a good example of a major independent who had become a major independent filmmaker is Alfred Hitchcock, who Selznick brings over from England in 38, 39. His first picture is Rebecca, which is released just weeks after Gone with the Wind. Selznick produces both of those movies. They went back to back Best Picture Oscars. But the interesting thing about Hitchcock is that he would learn to play the independent game under Selznick, and eventually would go independent very, very successfully in the 40s and 50s. So, but anyway, you had a system that cultivated talent, that had a dynamic relationship with the audience, and you had a couple of produced top executive production executives like Thalberg and Daryl Zanuck, who ran Warner Brothers and then left to start his own company, 20th Century Pictures, which merged with Fox, 20th Century Fox, which Zanuck ran for many years. But you had guys like Thalberg and Zanuck and Selznick who understood quality filmmaking, and they understood the importance of what they called back then prestige pictures, and they cranked them out along with the kind of the standard issue star vehicles that the studios were doing so effectively.
You mentioned genre there, Prof. Tom, and one of your other books that had a big influence is called Hollywood Genres. Could you speak to us a bit about that one?
Well, that was the first book that I wrote, and it was actually based on a dissertation that I wrote in the 70s with a couple of guys, Dudley Andrew and Rick Altman, co-supervising, that were crucial mentors of mine. But Dudley Andrew, in particular, a great film scholar, couldn't believe I wanted to write a book about Hollywood genres. Are you kidding? About cowboy movies and melodramas? But anyway, what occurred to me is I and like an awful lot of I'm of that kind of first generation of film scholars. I actually got PhDs in film studies, and as the American Academy was moving in that direction. And I mention that because my first couple of degrees were in literature. I, like an awful lot of people, early film scholars, came out of the humanities, and I learned to cut my teeth, studying literature and studying literary genres, and understanding genre and more literary terms, shall we say. And I was heavily influenced by a guy named John Cowalty, University of Chicago, Department of English, very much a literary scholar who did great work with literary genre as well as film genre. But the more I looked at Hollywood movies, and the more I looked at the so-called auteur theory, 60s into the 70s, the more it seemed to me that there was this very powerful dynamic within the production of movies between these great filmmakers, Howard Hawks, Alfred Hitchcock, John Ford, and so on and so forth, Vincent Minnelli, and the fact that they were genre filmmakers, these guys. I mean, that they specialized in formulas and formulaic filmmaking, and that these film genres, in their own way, were as important to the industry and to the American cinema as these individual filmmakers. As a matter of fact, the first chapter of Hollywood Genres was entitled "The Genius of the System," and that's where I first invoked that Bazan quote, as a way of thinking about the genius of the system was not only the production system, but the system of storytelling that Hollywood developed, and how important Westerns. This Universal book I'm working on. I'm just wrapping up the 1930s, and which is all about horror film, Universal's classic horror films, and John Stahl's classic melodramas, and I'm in the late 30s now, so here comes Deanna Durbin with these amazing musicals. And I'm heading into the 40s with Abbott and Costello. I mean, time and again, you see the situation where these genres, and I also argue in that book, and as you were saying in effect before about culture, is these are This is the mechanism whereby Hollywood, learns basically to articulate American culture, to develop this system whereby, in this interaction with the audience, the moviegoers, kind of systematically respond to what they like, and in the process, Hollywood reproduces more of it, and in the process, the basic values and dare we say ideology of America is being formulated and very actively, negotiated over time through lots and lots of movies.
And needless to say, it's impossible to think about this time without thinking about your book from the late 90s, Boom and Bust, about American film in the 40s. So this boom-bust cycle is a fascinating concept. Could you elaborate a bit on that?
Sure. So we were talking before about the Justice Department stepping in and eventually with the Paramount Decree in 1948, forcing the studios to divest their theaters and disintegrating the Hollywood studio system. I mention that because the Paramount that lawsuit was actually initiated in 1938. It took a full decade to play out. And it didn't play out during World War II because that was a period where the government wanted Hollywood to operate as a monopolistic system because it enabled the government to say, look, studios, if you want to stay in business during the war, you've got to support the war effort on a collective basis, which they did. What's interesting about the war boom, and the war boom was beyond comprehension in terms of what really ends the depression, was the war economy. As long, as much as Hollywood thought it was pulling itself out of the depression on multiple occasions, 36, 38, et cetera, it wasn't until 39, 40, 41, with the war economy, that Hollywood really, pulls itself out of that the American economy recovers and that Hollywood recovers from the depression. And you've got a situation where you've got in Japan and Germany and England and France, you've got basically these other national cinemas shut down or converted to war production in terms of documentaries and training films. And Hollywood does its share of that stuff. But basically, and this is Roosevelt being smart enough after Pearl Harbor in late 41 to realize that it would make sense for Hollywood to continue to produce quote unquote entertainment films if they supported the war effort. While the war economy is taking off, while the American economy is converting to war production, while you've got full employment, while you've got all these people because of rationing, et cetera, they don't have a lot to spend their money on except for, food and nightlife, where there's a lot of that going on during the war, and movies. So you've got a period during World War II, where the movie industry is doing just record business year after year after year, and that peaks in 1946 when the veterans come back. You have 10 million veterans, back, and you've got courtship patterns, et cetera. You get so the war boom really peaks in 1946, and it declines very rapidly in 47, 48, 49, basically with changes in the American economics, and you've got the moves to the suburbs. You've got the beginnings of suburban migration. You've got the beginnings of the family baby boom, which basically has will have by the late 40s, early 50s, more and more people staying home and watching TV rather than going to the movies. And you've got, the courts finally, after waylaying the antitrust action during the war, they come back with a vengeance, 46, 47, 48. And there are these other issues, HUAC. I mean, there are other pressures that are affecting the movie business as well. And it really is amazing how different the late 40s are from the early 40s. You've got this period of incredible prosperity. You've also got Hollywood doing a hell of a good job in terms of supporting the war effort. You've got, within by 1943, one third of all Hollywood movies are somehow related to the war. Homefront, war picture, combat movies, et cetera, et cetera. So, and you've also got Hollywood on an unprecedented level, making, newsreels and documentaries that are supporting the war effort. And that all changes pretty rapidly once the war ends. And by 46, 47, that's all ancient history.
It is indeed a remarkable moment, the televisualization and suburbanization of US life is an amazing change,
And certainly,
along with a freeway system
yes.
that really alters how things function. Plus, of course, the fact that it becomes a period of commercial aircraft expansion, so that it's easier for the suits in Manhattan to go over and bother the creatives in LA. Because I think you talked about that earlier as being one of the keys to the genius of the system. There was this separation and the relative difficulty of communication between the two poles of US cinema, the money and the art.
That's so true. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And you've got a situation too where you've got commercial television, is going coast to coast by the late 40s. You've got this new industry that is basically it's an advertising industry. It's a commercial television is not only about commercial interruptions of the programming. But the fact that the economics of that industry are fundamentally different from movies, and you've got a situation where the studios tried to fend off television as long and tried to kind of they're in a denial mode for several years till the mid 50s, really the big studios, and they finally throw in the towel and become contractors for the television industry, and by the late 50s, most of what the studios are producing our TV series. So you've got a, and that's a pretty dramatic change. You've also got a, when you think about what you were talking about before with, highways and automobiles and whatnot, you've got a transformation of movie going, in the post, by the end of World War II, there are a couple of dozen drive-in movie theaters in the US. By 1960, one third of all the movie screens in the US were drive-in movie theaters. And which is just indicative of how much things changed due to suburban migration, the family housing boom, and so on and so forth. And those properties would be scraped for eventually we'd have multiplex theaters and shopping malls, but that was not till the 70s. But you did have a significant transformation in movie going that coincided with the rise of television that really did just signal a sea change in terms of American culture and just the primary modes of storytelling in America.
So, Prof, I've got one more question for you, if I may, and then I'd like to throw it to you to add anything that we haven't touched on or add to something we have touched on. Is that okay?
Sure.
So, my first question is, how do you know all this shit? Where did you find this out? How did a humble English scholar reading literature, poetry, drama suddenly get to understand the economic and cultural infrastructure of the most dominant cultural industry of the world?
Part of it is just kind of following my intuitions, my instincts, and my inclinations. I often tell a story though of when I started researching the genius of the system, the Harry Ransom Center here at the University of Texas, which is a massive operation. That has lots and lots of collections, including the Selznick papers, lots and lots of film holdings. But they had acquired the Selznick stuff in the early 80s. And Selznick, as I said before, had Hitchcock under contract. And I thought I'd go check this stuff out. I knew I was going I wanted to write this book about the studio system. And so I thought I'd you know, take a look at some of this Hitchcock stuff. And the first files I asked to see were from the film Notorious. And as I went through these production files and these in-office memos and marketing reports and you know screenplay drafts, but more importantly than the screenplay drafts, actually the correspondence between the story department and the front office, et cetera, et cetera. As I read this stuff, not only did it fascinate me, but I realized I didn't know shit. I didn't know. I really, you know, I thought I knew how films got made, but having been, you know, I don't want to say indoctrinated, but having been heavily influenced by the, you know, by the auteur theory and so on and so forth. Anyway, the more I studied it, the more I realized that this production system and the storytelling process was far more complicated than I thought. And so there was that. And the and really all the way back to the genre book, I mean, I was interested just in this, in the industrial play. I mean, you know, just the way all the American culture industries and all culture industries, they're industries and they involve a fierce interplay of art and commerce, as you put it before. And the when things are working well, there is a certain equilibrium in that system. But the equilibrium is between art and commerce. You've really got to understand what's going on the commercial side to understand how that equilibrium is maintained and to understand how it gets thrown out of whack. I'm not sure where it came from, but I just have a fascination with the industrial aspects of the culture industries.
Well, I think once you get even a skerrick of interest in them, they don't let you go. When I was in college, David O. Selznick's memo book was remaindered. Nice, big, fat hardback. And I don't know why, but I read it and I just thought, this is what I need to understand.
Memo from David O. Selznick. That was that was quite a piece of work. Yes, and that was one of the first books of its kind. I mean, the first book to kind of get inside the movie industry. Very smart book. Really good book.
So, Prof, are there things that we've discussed where you'd like to add something, or things we haven't touched on?
You know, something I'll just end with kind of where things are right now. I just did a piece for The Nation on a special issue they did at the late December, early January, on the ongoing consolidation of the media industries and the impact. I may be talked down. The impact of streaming on the big six. I pulled this out of the epilogue for the new book, but you know, basically it's just trying to think through. Wow. I'm getting my coffee on the eggs there.
Take your time, take your time. I'm the guy who's been coughing and spluttering all the way through.
Actually, give me a second here. I have bad allergies and this happens once in a while.
Right.
Anyway, let's see if I can recover my vocal capacity here. I'm not used to talking this much. I'm not lecturing these days. But basically, here we go. What fascinates me is how long it took the traditional media powers to recognize the onslaught of the threat of streaming. I mentioned AOL and Vivendi, those mergers that went south, and they were anticipating digital delivery. But by the time it actually happens in the teens with Netflix and Amazon, by then the studios are pretty heavily invested in this international marketplace, the theatrical market, these blockbusters, they're doing great business. And by the mid-teens, and that as they begin to adjust and realize what's happening, it's too late. So you've got this situation where you've got, as I mentioned before, and I'll try to keep this short, but you got Disney Plus launched in November 2019, just weeks before the pandemic. And literally weeks before the pandemic is announced as such, and before the COVID-19, that is, before the pandemic will change everything, early to mid 2020. And I mentioned that because that accelerates streaming, and it enables particularly Netflix, but Disney Plus, which has a good head start. You've got a situation where we have a new duopoly in the media industries, and it's Netflix and Disney, and everyone else is chasing them. And all of these guys, the so-called legacy studios and these new players, and it's Microsoft, by the way, these partners. I blanked on Microsoft earlier, but Microsoft is one of these huge companies that's circling. Microsoft handled all of the Netflix advertising. They also are getting into gaming, as is Netflix. So we'll see if that evolves into something. But you've got to, we right now are in a period of transformation that is as profound as what we've seen before with the arrival of Hollywood, with the rise of television, and so on. And there's no telling where it's going to go. We talked before about the single biggest question I think right now in terms of Hollywood is what's going to happen to theatrical. And we just had the Barbenheimer thing and so on and so forth, but which seemed to indicate that the theatrical market is not altogether dead for old-fashioned quality movie making. And you've got this Marvel collapse, which is may or may not be a short-term phenomenon, but the things are wide open now in a way they haven't been in years. And as we come out of the pandemic, and with streaming, now part of the media landscape, and part of the cultural landscape for all, almost all of us, you've got more uncertainty now, I think, in terms of where entertainment and film and television are headed than ever.
Well, Professor Tom Schatz, on that note of pessimism or optimism, depending on your perspective, thank you so much for this incredibly valuable hour you spent telling
It's
us.
been great talking to you, Toby. It's good to see you.